So, you know, Gates is playing a fairly simplistic and insidious game by how he's constructing the argument about where we are now and deciding who he's going to in the South. This colored mayor you just heard, and then before that, it was Morgan Freeman, a rich Negro with millions of dollars in his pocket who can live damn good anywhere. I mean, you got millions of dollars in your pocket, you can live anywhere. You can live on Mars good. But now, let's go into another area where Gates is exploring how well we have been integrated and what that all means. Check this out.
I've often said that if there's any city in America that should accentuate the values and the principles that Dr. King stood for, it should be Memphis.
One of the most dramatic examples of how Memphis has embraced the ideals of Dr. King is the transformation of its police force. During the Civil Rights era, the police in the South were symbols of institutional racism, brutality, and terror. They were the official face of white oppression. Even today, I'm always frightened when I see a flashing police car speeding up behind me. Like many black people growing up here, James Bolden was terrified of the police. But in 1968, he joined the Memphis Police Department, determined to change things. He was one of only 65 black officers in a force of 2,000. Today, he's the chief. You're 20 years old, and it's just a few months after Dr. King's assassinated. What was the force like?
It was male, white, dominated. When I came on the job, we didn't have many aspirations of ever achieving any type of rank or anything like that, because commanding officers, black, as you know, as far as that concerned, were practically non-existent. So we didn't see very much in form of role models or anything like that of blacks holding positions in the Memphis Police Department. We had certain areas of the city in which, you know, we could patrol, and others we couldn't.
You couldn't, even as a police officer?
Even as a police officer, we were assigned to certain areas within the city, and generally they were areas that were occupied by the black community, and we didn't police outside of that community.
In 1973, Bolden founded the Afro-American Police Association to make the police a force against racism, not an example of it. He petitioned the federal government to get more blacks hired and promoted to executive positions.
It wasn't met, you know, with open arms. There were white officers who refused to ride in a squad car with me. There were black officers who would turn their backs on me, wouldn't speak to me because they were afraid that I would bring trouble to them.
Were you worried that maybe an accident might befall you from some of your white colleagues?
That was with me every day. Every day. I would go to work, and sometimes you can't imagine getting home at night. You're so terrified, you know, because who wouldn't be when you had to face something like that and everyone is walking around you, they're wearing guns.
When did you know that you were winning? I mean, how did you build consensus? How did you melt down some of these old crackers and make them start to accept what you were trying to do?
Around the year of 1978, finally the federal government agreed that there had been discrimination in the Memphis Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
And a consent decree was entered by the city.
It took them five years to admit what you could observe in five seconds, right?
Yeah. So as a result of the increase in hiring of minorities, more opportunities began to open up. You look at the city of Memphis Police Department now. I have two deputy chiefs that work under my command that are African Americans. Our precincts throughout the city are equally divided. We have women in leadership positions in the police department. You cannot find an area within the Memphis Police Department where minorities or blacks are not represented.
Hmm.
Things have changed so dramatically in the South. You know, I've had the distinction of living through the times when we could not drink at a water fountain, when we could not go to the library on a certain day, when we couldn't go to a movie, and when we couldn't eat at a restaurant. So for anyone to say that the South has not changed, then they're fooling themselves.
Okay, so once again, the way Gates has constructed this is he's gone to another color. This is the colored now chief of police. And it's either symbolic or symbolism of rigid forms of Jim Crowism, water fountainism, stuff like that. Now we can drink there. Or now we have certain positions like being a chief of police or Negroes in the police force who can also follow out masses' policies of war on drugs to round up black people and throw them into prison. In other words, what I'm saying is that there hasn't been a transformation of the way and the role of the police. It's just that now you have more blacks playing a role in the role of the police. Look, the fact that you had many blacks in South Africa who were actually cops did not mean that the oppression and the role of the police in South Africa was any different. So the fact that you now have Negro chiefs of police, as if that's supposed to symbolize, well, see, that's what Gates is doing. He's a symbolic historian, and he's a symbolic movement maker. He believes that integrating into the system without a critical examination and transformation of the system itself or destruction of the system is not necessary. Because, see, that's not what he believes in. Now, you have this stuff where we've seen chiefs of police all over the place in L.A. What does that mean? Nothing. We've seen Rampart Division cops run amok and roust up and throw in over 100 black and brown innocent people. And the story only gets out because one little pig gets caught stealing 8 pounds of cocaine, doesn't want to do his whole sentence, so he starts ratting on his fellow pigs. That's how the story breaks. And that's how the 100-plus people end up getting out of prison. Now, we've seen, and I mentioned before, Tulia, Texas, 10% of the black population. We've seen in Mississippi and Tennessee the annual Good Old Boy picnic where racist cops all over the country would gather together and fly the Confederate flag, sell T-shirts of King and a crosshair, have various Redneck of the Year Award skits, where in one case one person who won the Redneck of the Year Award pretended like he was walking down the street. A watermelon falls out of a watermelon truck. He breaks open the watermelon. Inside there is a black baby doll. He shows the black baby to the crowd and says, "We must destroy the seed." Throws the doll on the ground and begins stomping it together. This is some Nazi stuff. The only reason why the case got broken or the case came out was some Klansmen friends of the cops, of these various different law enforcement, FBI, you know, on down the line, regular, you know, cops and stuff like that, ATF. One of them, some of them had gotten into a falling out with some of the fellow Klansmen. And when that took place, the Klansmen got upset and came to the annual Good Old Boy picnic with video cameras. And they videotaped the whole thing, showed all of these cops there, you know, all Nazi'd out, having these skits and everything, and then released it to the public. It was so vile and so obviously racist that even the Soldiers of Fortune magazine ran an article talking about how openly racist it was. Now, when the Soldiers of Fortune magazine, which is a mercenary magazine, this is a magazine for armed mercenaries to go out and get hooked up and carry out missions for the imperialists throughout the world. When even they're shocked by the blatant racism of the annual Good Old Boys, then that's saying something right there. But did Gates mention them? Did he go to some of the blacks who had encountered and found out about the annual Good Old Boys picnic? Or any of these other things like Tulia, Texas? No. Did he go to the death rows of the South where Gary Graham was executed? No, he did not. He could have done some fact-finding mission showing the disparity of blacks on death row and how and who and what it takes to get you on death row, meaning who you kill and who you don't kill, meaning what color they are. Recently, HBO did a special where it was like this little 13-year-old brother who was accused of killing a white woman. She was with her husband, and the culprit robbed and shot them. It was clear from the description, because they followed this whole case, and it was like a thing almost like OJ. They followed this whole case as they were trying to defend this brother. It was clear that he didn't fit the description of the person, except he didn't have on the same gear. It was just nothing worked. Anyway, he ends up somehow having some kind of confession, quote unquote, written up on him. Now, the confession was basically more or less beaten out of him, literally. And who was the person who beat him up to get this so-called confession? A Negro cop. So once again, without examining the role of the police, currently and historically, and just talking about now there's more Negroes in the police force, as if that in itself is a transformation of society or the police, is the height of illusion.
The reason, one of the reasons that black mayors started to show up, that police started to show up, more black police, police chiefs, is because there was a series of riots in the 60s. They used to call them the hot summers. And what the bourgeoisie was trying to do by having the promotion of black public officials, be they police chiefs, mayors, this type of stuff, more visible black participation. You look at, if you look at the news, you think, the hell, black people doing pretty good. Got a whole lot of news announcers and everything. But this is to prevent struggle.
That's the symbolic stuff I'm talking about.
That's right. And the reason it's important to them is because they hope that it will prevent struggle. They hope that it will give the illusion of black progress. They hope that it will slow down and cool off the anger. You see, well, Blood just became the chief of police. What's wrong with you?
And that's what Gates' role is. That's what he's doing. And that's why he's ignoring the other element of black resistance that has always been a current of critiquing what we're integrating, quote unquote, into and where we are in this society. Frederick Douglass wrote classic works about the plight of the Indians because he started to see that the struggle for black people was interconnected with what happened in the plight of Indians and the system that created the conditions for the destruction of the Native Aboriginal population. Now, next, Gates goes into another world of the former segregation apparatus of American society. Let's see where he takes it, and then we'll take it from there. Check this.
You might want to get some practice.
In just 30 years, the police and the city government of Memphis have been able to make profound changes. But is that true of all institutions in the South? This is Fort Benning, Georgia, home to over 30,000 raw recruits. $20 26% of the United States Army is black. But historically, the military was just as segregated as the police. And as a society, it was charged to defend. Today, the Army boasts that it's an army of one. I asked Lieutenant Colonel Sando if the Army is as integrated as it claims.
What's this rose gallery for?
this is the battalion leadership, our chaplain, Chaplain Stokeland, a black female.
Hey, not bad.
The only one I've ever seen in our Army, and she does a great job for us. Our personnel officer, our operations officer, our supply officer, and then six company commanders and their first sergeant.
Man, a lot of color on that wall.
Within our battalion, I have six companies. Two of my company commanders are black. Of the six first sergeants, three of them are black. Of the five battalions here in the infantry training brigade, one of the battalion commanders is black. Three of the command sergeant majors are black. Mm-hmm. From my experience, for, you know, 21 years now, commissioned service, is that, you know, I truly believe that the Army is colorblind. Mm-hmm. I truly believe that I'm colorblind. We reward excellence. We promote soldiers and officers based on merit and demonstrated potential.
How can the Army achieve such spectacular results in terms of this colorblind society that you described? I mean, how does it work? The Army was notoriously racist. My father was in the Army during World War II. I mean, he had horror stories when I was growing up. And now the Army's held up as a model for what a colorblind society could be. How did you guys do that?
Well, I can't speak for, you know, the previous 50 years of racial integration. The Armed Forces were the first institution in our country to be racially integrated.
Under President Truman.
Yes, sir. So under no, you know, for no other reason than, you know, we had to make it work, and we're going to make it work.
I am the infantry!
To make this work, each barracks is assigned an equal opportunity officer to deal directly with any race complaints.
Okay, so you see right there, once again, here Gates goes in and says, now the Army is held up as a model for what a colorblind society should be. What it also should be held up as is a unconscious element of the society. And what that means for U.S. imperialism. See, there's no critique about, once again, about black people integrating into the armed force of the imperialists. And what that means throughout the planet. When Ali refused to go into the Vietnam, be drafted into the Vietnam, a soldier for the Vietnam War, into the Vietnam War, all across the world, people came out in support. In Pakistan, young Pakistanians fasted for days in support of what Ali did. In other words, they saw Ali as a symbol of a black person to be emulated because he stood against being a tool of imperialism. Gates' vision of black people is not to critique the tool of imperialism. It's just to integrate into it and thereby be an apparatus of the oppression. He starts off, way of all places, where does he start off? We're now in Fort Benning, Georgia, where there's thousands of recruits. 26% are black. Fort Benning, Georgia is the home of School of the Americas.
Certainly is.
That has devastated the planet. This school straight out of hell, as my commentary's called, outlines all types of tyranny and oppression that these graduates and their teachers have fostered on the third world. So being a part of that apparatus means you're part of the problem. You're part of an engine of destruction that's making a wasteland of society. But Gates frames black emancipation in the form of blacks integrating within into the system, not in the tradition of blacks critiquing the system or challenging the system. So this is at core, once again, where you see the discrepancy of where many blacks started to examine and re-examine what it means to be in America. So the platform of, you know, of where the Panthers stood as far as saying black men should be exempt from military service, to Malcolm's criticism of the military and its imperialist role throughout Africa and Vietnam and South America, Gates does not want that element of black resistance in history to even be discussed. All we should concern ourselves with in the world of Gates is if we get a piece of the rotten pie on Massa's plantation,
eat it up.
We should be satisfied. And as long as he doesn't look at us twice for being black, for getting that piece of the rotten pie, then we should even be more satisfied.
And that was Tracy James and Gerald Smith of Slave Revolt Radio in Berkeley, California. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. We'll conclude with our next installment of readings from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. Last week, we read from Chapter 12, which was entitled Neutral Voices, that talked about the social institutions, particularly parts of the educational system, whose actual function is to cool out those who are going to be disappointed in achieving the life and career goals that they believe society gives them the opportunity to attain. But this opportunity is illusory and reserved for only a few by design. For everyone else, the losers must be reconciled to performing their assigned roles in the social hierarchy. This week, we're going on to Chapter 13, which is titled Subordination, and Jeff Schmidt writes, the expletive deleted computers. When an interviewer asked young nuclear weapons designers at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory to name the worst thing about their profession, this gripe about uncooperative computers was a typical answer. The goddamn computers, they don't have enough capacity and they're always going down. What's a designer of weapons of mass destruction to do? The physicists' startlingly narrow answers were not the result of any pressure to respond quickly, without giving careful consideration to the question. The interviewer reports that nearly all of them did think for a while before answering. Rather, a narrow focus comes naturally to such individuals, who, as good products of the system of professional training, give higher priority to carrying out their assignments than to questioning them, and in any case are not prepared to second-guess the political and ideological framework that engenders and guides their technical work. In the final analysis, the physicists' narrow answers are a sad sign of their subordination, of their approval of a work life that will ultimately give them insufficient satisfaction, a work life in which their employers define the big picture and they innovate safely within it, and in which attempting to alter the picture is not a legitimate on-the-job activity. If an individual professional did have an independent political agenda, it would undermine the ideological discipline and assignable curiosity that ensure that he works in his employer's interest. This is why the system of professional training and the examination that stands at the center of that system favors the individual who sees himself as having a technical orientation rather than a political one. Of course, the technical is itself political, The technically best solution to a given problem is often the one thing from the point of view of those with an interest in maintaining the hierarchy, but something quite different from the point of view of those without power. However, the favored individual sees no class interest in his own work. Because he internalizes the requisite ideology, he doesn't see himself as following an ideology at all, but as simply doing what he judges to be technically best. The politics usually enter his work not through conscious plotting or calculation, but automatically, when he does what feels right. The result is an ironic situation in which this very political worker sees politics as a dirty word, a word that means not doing what is technically best. Having long ago purged himself of his own political agenda, and having internalized the dominant ideology, the expert sees the problems of the world as fundamentally technical in nature, although certainly exacerbated by politics, but not the other way around. As a 28-year-old Livermore physicist working on third-generation nuclear weapons, which aim to knock out attacking nuclear weapons, said about the buildup of nuclear arsenals, why not find technical solutions to a technical problem? Whatever the issue, the rebel and the expert stand out in sharp distinction to each other. In any discussion, the expert's lack of political independence, his loyalty, becomes apparent immediately as he confines his thinking to technical solutions, making adjustments, fine-tuning the system. He may offer a multitude of ways to deal with a problem, but, as if by magic, not a single one would reduce the flow of profits or otherwise disturb the hierarchical distribution of power. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives, written by Jeff Schmidt and published in the year 2000. Going on with the next subsection of Chapter 13, which is titled Professionalism. Professionalism, in particular, the notion that experts should confine themselves to their legitimate professional concerns, quote-unquote, and not, quote, politicize their work, helps keep individual professionals in line by encouraging them to view their narrow technical orientation as a virtue, a sign of objectivity rather than of subordination. This doesn't mean that experts are forbidden to let independent political thoughts cross their minds. They can do so as citizens, of course, and they can do so even as experts, but then only in the proper places and in the proper way. The expert is probably a member of a professional association that has a committee on social implications or a forum on the profession and society. Such a group may take up a political issue, but only after it takes a debilitating bow to power, usually in the form of a protracted debate in which those who want to take up the issue must succeed in repackaging it as a legitimate professional concern, often as a technical issue. Members of the group can then take a position on the sanitized issue without, quote, being political, in the sense of acting like they don't know their place. Politically timid professionals fear that their organization will look like part of a social movement, and so they try to limit their organization's actions to those of a narrow special interest group. As part of their very identity, professionals subordinate themselves to power on ideological matters. Thus, professionals can't take a stand on an unsanitized issue without going through a genuine identity crisis. Indeed, they respond with great fear and trembling whenever anyone proposes that they take such a stand. Even on life or death issues, professional associations can rarely muster the courage to take a position that they think might displease employers. Professionals don't want anyone to think that their own views might affect their work, because that would be insubordinate and therefore unprofessional. So even off the job, in professional associations and elsewhere, independence of thought feels out of line. As a result, the typical professional doesn't stand for anything. Thus, for example, it was sad but not surprising when the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association decided not to participate in the massive 25th of April, 1993 Gay Rights March on Washington, an event that drew several hundred thousand people, making it one of the largest civil rights demonstrations in American history. Leroy Ahrens, the group's president, explained that members didn't want to endanger their credibility in the industry, quote unquote. As good little professionals, they adjust their very identity for their employers, both on and off the job. They act like journalists who happen to be gay, not like gays who happen to work as journalists. Consider the behavior of the National Association of Black Journalists in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a well-known journalist convicted of killing a Philadelphia police officer. A passionate voice for the black community, Abu-Jamal had worked as a radio and print journalist doing news reports and commentary for a number of radio stations and networks, including National Public Radio, which aired his pieces on All Things Considered. The incident that landed Abu-Jamal in prison occurred in 1981, while he was president of the Philadelphia chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists. Late one night, Abu-Jamal happened upon the scene where a police officer had stopped Abu-Jamal's brother for a traffic violation. In the events that followed, the officer shot Abu-Jamal and was fatally shot himself. There is no agreement about who fired first or who shot the officer. Many people felt that Abu-Jamal, a radical and longtime activist with no criminal record, did not receive a fair trial. But years of appeals through the courts were fruitless, and on June 1, 1995, the governor of Pennsylvania ordered prison officials to kill Abu-Jamal by lethal injection at 10 p.m. on August 17, 1995. This touched off a worldwide outcry involving hundreds of thousands of people. Demonstrations, rallies, teach-ins, celebrity speak-outs, op-ed articles, and letter-writing and petition campaigns. 100,000 signers in Rome alone demanded that Abu-Jamal at least be granted a new trial. Scores of organizations, from Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch to the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, supported the demand and opposed Abu-Jamal's impending execution, but not the National Association of Black Journalists. In a written statement following a vote by the group's 18-member board of directors, NABJ President Dorothy Butler Gilliam said, "As an organization of journalists, NABJ does not see this unfortunate circumstance as an issue of journalism upon which it feels compelled to take a stand at this time." In spite of Gillian's attempt to make her position sound more reasonable by calling NABJ an organization of journalists rather than an organization of blacks, the group's stand infuriated many people, especially in the black community. One critic spoke for them all when he attributed the group's decision to its domination by members attuned to the subtle grunts and imagined nods of their employers in the corporate media. In response to the barrage of criticism that it received, the NABJ latched onto and took an extra strong stand on a sanitized issue, restrictions that prison officials had put on Abu-Jamal's communication with the outside world after he contracted to write Live from Death Row, a book sharply critical of the justice and prison system. Thus, the NABJ was outraged, not because the state planned to kill Abu-Jamal, but because it was violating his First Amendment rights, which we find to be a legitimate issue, the group explained. The judge in charge of Abu-Jamal's case was a tough, cop-on-the-bench type who had sentenced 32 people to death, more than twice as many as any other judge in the country. He had never before granted a stay of execution and was, in the words of the New York Times, openly contemptuous of Abu-Jamal. Yet, 10 days before the planned execution, he succumbed to the growing popular pressure and granted Abu-Jamal an indefinite stay, allowing Abu-Jamal's lawyers to appeal once again to higher courts for a new trial. Generally speaking, the greater the power, whether corporate or state or even oppositional, the more eager professionals are to subordinate themselves to it. The power's morality or immorality usually has only a secondary effect on the professional's eagerness to serve, because good subordinates don't make moral judgments about their superiors. This is the unfortunate but invaluable lesson of history. Historian Conrad Jarisch notes, for example, that in the spring of 1933, most German professionals rushed to curry favor with the new Nazi government. The prestigious German Engineering Association, the Prominent Lawyers Association, the Secondary Teachers Association, and the hundreds of other groups all across Germany pledged their loyalty. The behavior of people in my own field, physics, has been far from exemplary. Before and during World War II, the world's top physicists were German, and these individuals typically accepted invitations to work in support of the Nazi war effort. Two decades later, during the Vietnam War, the world's top physicists were American, and these individuals typically jumped at the invitation to become members of the Defense Department's JASON organization and work in support of the U.S. side in Vietnam. At the workplace, experts can be somewhat independent in informal discussions, but almost never within their professional work itself. It is considered unprofessional for experts to bring independent political thinking to bear in their work. On the job, their, quote, legitimate professional concerns are largely confined to carrying out their assignments. Thus, while some of the nuclear weapons designers mentioned at the beginning of this chapter worried about computer troubles, others, also well trained in confining themselves to their legitimate professional concerns, worried that international agreements might further restrict testing and thereby make it more difficult for them to carry out their assignment of weapons design. They did not allow the notion that such restrictions on nuclear testing might actually represent social progress to interfere with their work. This view of what is legitimate holds hegemony over professionals in every major area of their employment. It is extreme in some cases, such as the aerospace industry, employer of thousands of scientists. The very notion of an aerospace scientist bringing a critical social perspective to his work is so unusual as to be jarring. The social function of the individual produced by the qualification system is to work uncritically within the political hierarchy, bolstering it through his example of eager participation as well as through his actual work product. When the professional leaves unchallenged the moral authority of his employer to dictate the political context of his work, he surrenders his social existence, his control over the mark he makes on the world. These days, one finds students and professionals who have some awareness of the big picture, but who cynically adjust their behavior for the system. This is quite acceptable to the hierarchy because these individuals, even as they blast distant power figures such as the president, carefully avoid any confrontation with those who hold immediate power over them. As Max Horkheimer said in 1946, in what may be taken as one of the most succinct criticisms of many professionals on today's postmodern scene, well-informed cynicism is only another mode of conformity. However, more than professionalism or cynicism, it is a lack of social vision that assures conformity, and professional training does anything but produce people who envision a more democratic social order. Professionals may complain to you about the unfair treatment that they witness firsthand at work, and they may tell you in excruciating detail about the latest cases of corruption in business and government, just as they read it in the newspaper. But most of them are unable to move from concern to action. Professionals are angry about such abuses of power, but having no vision of how power in the schools, in the workplace, and in the larger society could be distributed more democratically, They naturally look for ways to make the present hierarchical power structure work. Here the choices are limited. Restaff the hierarchy with, quote, better people, or give those at the top even more power so they can act decisively. So even the most well-meaning individuals end up reinventing some such elitist or authoritarian solution. Group action by the rank and file is disobedient and antithetical to making hierarchical authority structures work. So many professionals who are well-informed and concerned about abuses of power will nevertheless not engage in collective acts of solidarity with the victims. They don't seek solidarity, even when they themselves are the victims, and it is not unusual to see them leave their jobs rather than speak out openly and improve the situation through collective action. For the same reason, they will not identify with a specific movement or work with organizations that have independent social agendas. Those who have no vision of greater democracy are paralyzed even further by the individualism inherent in their outlook. They retreat in fear at the mere suggestion of joining with others in struggle. For those who act as part of a group, admit to being less than autonomous individuals, and give up the comforting fiction that they meet their bosses as equals. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Continuing on with the next subsection of Chapter 13, Conflicts with Employers. The professional, like any employee, does have conflicts with his employer. But because he is an intellectual employee, he is not free to arrive at just any understanding of the root cause of these on-the-job disputes. Specifically, under normal circumstances, he cannot allow himself to view his problems with his employer as an outgrowth of a fundamental conflict of interest. For to do so would sabotage the ideological discipline that allows him to serve his employer's interest in his work and keep his job as a professional. Thus, the professional sees his clashes as originating in conflicting technical judgments over how best to pursue universal interests. He sees conflicting strategies or personalities, but doesn't see himself as having a fundamental conflict of interest with his employer, or with the powerful in society in general. That is, he doesn't see his own conflict with his employer as part of a larger conflict between labor and capital. When those who would wield power act against his and his fellow employees' interests, the professional does not see them as opponents acting against employee interests, but as incompetence acting against universal interests. Thus, he calls not for breaking down the hierarchy and distributing power democratically to those who do the work, but for more intelligence at the top, an elitist approach, which weakens alliances with non-professionals. He challenges the staffing, not the structure. He fumes. Incompetence! Stupid bureaucrats! Those idiots don't know what they're doing. In the eyes of the professional, those with authority at worst lack intelligence or information. He dared not admit to himself that those he serves may be smart and well-informed, but simply have different class interests. That is, he cannot risk admitting to himself that he has been hired to serve interests that conflict with his own. This restricted understanding renders the professional weak as a force for his own defense and impotent as a force for change in society. His protestations are impotent because no matter how militantly stated, they are not threats to break down ideological discipline. They don't threaten to affect the political content of his work, as having an independent political agenda certainly would. Even his strongest indictment of decisions made by management, it's all political, suggests a mythical non-political approach rather than an alternative distribution of political power. The louder he shouts his carefully restricted criticisms, the more he proclaims his subordination. No professional maintains perfect ideological discipline, and every straying leads to a run-in with management. Of course, some professionals have more clashes than others. In particular, those who are the least strict about subordinating their own vision to that of the institution that employs them are the ones who find themselves in trouble most often. But these conflict-plague employees rarely understand that their poor ideological discipline is the source of their clashes. They avoid such an understanding because it is inherently radical. It exposes their employer's ideology and is critical of it. To avoid taking such a radical step, professionals come up with other, often far-fetched, explanations of their conflicts with management, as the following discussion of two common types of workplace conflict suggests. Let's look first at conflicts over employees' demands for excellence, and then at conflicts over employers' demands for conformity. Employers reward mediocrity and punish excellence. At least that's what many disillusioned professionals have concluded. In reality, of course, management has no such operating principle. Yet countless professionals have found that when they take initiative on the job and work with dedication to further the ends they thought they were hired to further, they get criticism from the boss, or they are treated as some sort of threat. Meanwhile, they see that co-workers with take-the-money-and-run attitudes are hassled less. When devoted professionals complain that they are given grief for doing outstanding work, you usually find that they have decided for themselves which aspects of their jobs deserve the highest priority and the most attention. This assertion of their own agenda, not the excellence with which they pursue it, is what gets them in trouble. The chance to work toward their own goals renews their enthusiasm and inspires them to do what they feel is unusually excellent work. Co-workers typically agree, as do clients, but management is unhappy. Professionals, bewildered by their boss's negative reaction to their special efforts, but unable to recognize the difference between their agenda and their employer's, conclude that the problem is that management is too stupid to recognize quality work. What is really a conflict over goals appears to professionals to be a dispute over excellence. Other professionals escape such disputes. These are the individuals whose goals match those of the institutions that employ them, or who are willing and able to subordinate their own goals. Institutions demand conformity and obedience, and yet hire professionals to do work that requires creativity and questioning. Does this make employer-employee conflict inevitable? Liberals say yes. They enjoy believing that intellectuals are unbridled thinkers and therefore a threat to those in power. This is a corollary of their elitist belief that non-intellectual workers support the status quo. But I would argue that institutional demands for political conformity lead to conflict only when individual creative workers have independent political agendas and are not willing to subordinate them. For if professionals adopt their employers' agendas, then their creativity and questioning work is toward meeting their employers' goals. The work product, in that case, is essentially the same as it would be had the employers done the creative work themselves. The sad fact is, mainstream professionals don't need political freedom to do their creative work, and they don't demand that their employers allow them to exercise political freedom in their work. Only when professionals have an independent political agenda do they need and demand freedom, because only then might their creative work displease their employers. Scientists are a good example. During Joseph Stalin's reign of terror in the Soviet Union, tens of thousands of scientists and engineers were arrested, imprisoned, and sometimes executed. Yet Soviet science advanced rapidly and came to lead the world in many fields, including mathematics and theoretical physics. Until the mid-1950s, some of the Soviet Union's most eminent scientists worked in prison laboratories. At the height of the repression, Soviet physicists did work that won them 5 Nobel Prizes. One of those physicists, a Soviet citizen named Pyotr Kapitsa, had been living in England for 13 years when, upon a routine visit to the Soviet Union to attend a conference, Soviet authorities seized him on Stalin's orders and wouldn't let him return home to England. Within a few years of this kidnapping, Stalin had Kapitsa running a Soviet laboratory and doing the most creative work of his career. As Lauren R. Graham, a science historian at Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has documented, scientists do not require academic freedom to do their creative work. They just need funding. One haunting image that Graham describes is that of the young scientist Andrei Sakharov sitting at his desk at Arzamas 16 doing his famous work in theoretical physics and gazing out the window at brutal armed guards marching rows of political prisoners to their jobs at the scientific installation, which was the Soviet equivalent of the Los Alamos National Laboratory in the United States. Years later, Sakharov became a dissident, but that was unusual for a scientist. As Graham notes, even when the Soviet Union was on the verge of collapse, the leaders of Soviet science sided with the old order. Those naive enough to believe that the professionals' creative thinking alone leads to conflict with management probably also subscribe to the myth that intellectual workers' professional obligations lead to conflict too. No one illustrates better than the mainstream journalist that there is no tension between fulfilling a professional obligation or doing a professional job and institutional demands for conformity and obedience. Reporters who write front-page stories for the New York Times are considered to be among the top journalists in the profession. It is abundantly evident that the paper they work for requires that the stories be written within a framework of general support for the U.S. political and economic system, and that the stories anticipate and head off any possible faith-threatening interpretations of the facts being reported. Times reporters conform strictly to the paper's politics and at the same time feel that they are fulfilling their professional obligations to, quote, get the story. There's rarely a serious complaint from either side. Only when professionals have an independent political agenda do they argue with their bosses about what constitutes a professional job. When Times editors assign one of their politically reliable, top-of-the-line journalists to cover a sensitive story, they don't worry that professional obligations will lead their reporter to frame the story in a way that skewers the paper's fundamental tenets. Thus, for example, most mainstream media in the end reported the Watergate affair not as evidence of the political system's tendency toward corruption, but as evidence that the system works and cleanses itself. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. And on to the conclusion of Chapter 13, which is titled Subordination, with the final subsection titled Pre-Professionals. As we know, not all students become clones of the prototypical professional described above. But those who are headed in that direction are easy to spot, because their subordinate attitude is conspicuous early on at the training institution. These students scramble to figure out the rules of the game in their university graduate department or professional school, and then they literally compete to adjust themselves appropriately. Being not merely adjustable but self-adjusting, they are good students in the eyes of the faculty. For the same reason, they will be good professionals in the eyes of their employers. These students do not simply refrain from acts of insubordination, such as challenging the training institution's agenda or criticizing the ways that agenda reflects the needs of the larger system. Rather, they enthusiastically embrace the system of professional qualification and defend the qualifying examination. The personal strategy of these skilled submissives is to play the game, to use the qualifying examination to demonstrate on the system's terms that they are good, that is, well adapted, to be certified with a credential, and to get a job with a new set of rules to submit to. In short, this means integrating themselves into the system, being dwarfed by it but surviving, if not as independent forces for change in society, then at least as well-fed biological entities serving the status quo. These students also subordinate the dreams they once had of experiencing the totality of their subject in all its technical and social dimensions. In what can be seen as a sad attempt to imitate this foregone experience, some students treat the small problem parts assigned to them as if they were interesting enough in and of themselves to play the role of a surrogate totality. Today, these assignments are the catechism-like test preparation problems. Tomorrow, the narrow thesis problems, and thereafter, the corporate problem segment. Many students do resist making the appropriate adjustments and heading down the designated road. Unwilling to reorient their outlook and goals, they find themselves in conflict with one or another action or policy of the training institution. These students usually struggle individually and indirectly, misunderstanding their problems in the training program as simply personal and not as the inevitable result of the system-serving nature of the training institution's goals. Though they often leave the training program, they should not be looked at as losers, for they have not necessarily been broken and may go on to struggle elsewhere. The system of professional training is set up to turn students into good self-adjusters or else get rid of them. Through the mechanisms of pressure and scrutiny that I have described in this book, it usually succeeds in doing one or the other. However, students can and sometimes do frustrate the system by both confronting it and remaining, but this is accomplished only through politically conscious, organized action, as I discuss in the next two chapters. At the core of the conflict is an unstated but highly contentious issue. Who will the student become? Professional training programs work routinely, methodically, and often consciously to turn students into very different persons, and so individuals who want to control who they are must fight to do so. And that has been the conclusion of Chapter 13, Subordination, from the book Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. And Schmidt himself is one of those people that survived the training system with his values intact. He has a PhD in physics and worked for 19 years as a writer and editor of the publication Physics Today. However, he did come into conflict with his employers for his independent thinking and was fired from his job after publishing this book. If you'd like to find out more about this book, Disciplined Minds, or about Jeff Schmidt, he has a website, disciplinedminds.com. And one of the things that you can find there is a petition drive that's being signed by scientists all over the world to help him get his job back. And if you've missed previous readings from the book, we're almost at the end, and from here on in he's going to talk about how to resist indoctrination. You can listen to previous chapters which have been read on the program at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening. The rich will come.